Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We're going to have an interesting show this evening. We're going to be talking with James Horak, who has an interesting website called emvsinfo.blogspot.com. He talks a lot about the designers of our solar system, these electromagnetic vehicles that are near our sun and near Saturn. And we also have Barbara DeLong, who has an interesting, a really excellent show on Blog Talk Radio called Nightlight, and she is herself an author, and I've talked to her about her books before. But tonight we're going to be focusing on this event that is coming in October. And I think FEMA is preparing for some huge event October 1st, and Barbara, do you think that we are going to see the New Madrid fault line get triggered with a large earthquake? So do you think that the elite are going to use HAARP or a buried nuclear warhead to create a massive earthquake in the eastern United States? Are you getting any kind of intuitive kind of feeling about this?
Well, I had been getting for a month or so a feeling that there was something coming, there was something that was going to cause upheaval of you know, a great magnitude. And I started to get that area up and down the Mississippi, which is the New Madrid Fault Line. And then I ran across all of the material on FEMA and what they're making preparations for and all of the stuff that has to be in place by October 1st. And then I started to realize that if there is a national disaster, the government can order troops in. And then I remembered the 800 FEMA camps that are set up for containment and the fact that they are all now fully operational. And then I saw the stuff about school children being given 3 days water, 3 days food supply in a survival pack almost. And then there was also the suggestion about, you know, massive global upheaval. And, you know, I kind of put it all together, and it does feel as though there is going to be a major event. And the government knows about it, so it can't be a natural disaster. So it has to be something that is triggered. And then I got the feeling that the government was a puppet government, and I don't have a great deal of expertise in all this stuff. So,
Painter, we're getting some really strange background noise.
That's coming from her.
Barbara, are you sure you don't have an ET craft outside your window or something? You're getting some weird background noise.
I'll go look.
Oh, no. See, it's all gone now. That's very strange. Isn't that bizarre? I wonder what that's all about.
While I was talking about all that is when it happened.
Here it comes again. So you mentioned all these FEMA camps becoming operational. So
yeah.
does that mean there are people that are now working at these camps?
They are not only staffed, but ads have been in the paper for people to apply for the jobs that have experience in containing civil unrest.
Well,
fan,
James,
right there.
Huh?
I was asking if she had a fan blowing on her.
I don't know what that is, man. That is very weird. James, do you have any comment on these 800 FEMA camps that are becoming operational?
Well, they probably have been operational for a while now. We know they're there. We know that they're stocked and have been supplied with the foodstuffs for a short duration if they were full. We know that they have guard towers, that they have razor wire, that they are built in such a way as to keep people in rather than keep anything out. And we know that the mandates FEMA has do involve some degree of secrecy in their job description. The fact that there have been corporations supplying them with three-man coffins and that these exist and have been found by people like Jesse Ventura and Alex Jones. I would be interested also in mentioning that starting about 5 years ago, there were all kinds of facilities in Canada and the United States stocking up on body bags. So they've been planning for some kind of event now for a while. Things have come into to suggest that ISON has some amazing electromagnetic phenomena attached to it, as well as seeming to be tri-nuclear. You remember Hale-Bopp was dual nuclear, and that it had two bodies or two nuclei. ISON is even more spectacular, and I would imagine that they are hiding some of the things that they may have found out about it, but it could be used in some convoluted way as a pretense for concern. There are all sorts of things in the making. Destabilization of the New Madrid Fault Zone is a fact. The reports that we have seen of perhaps a slant drill on that hole in the Gulf of Mexico at BP created such a disaster with, it could have, as some people suggested, facilitate an erosion of the salt dome beneath four states. There are all kinds of possibilities, and we know that there were some subterranean explosions that occurred about 7 months ago at very near the foot of that fault zone. And it just goes on and on. So they have all kinds of pretexts. They have all kinds of triggers to pull. But bear in mind that they don't have to do that to declare martial law.
Well, can you hear me? I put my headset on to see. I know those camps have been sort of in the planning and functional for a great deal of time. My question is, you know, why weren't they used when Katrina hit? Why weren't they used when Sandy hit? I mean, we've had national disasters here that those camps would have been a wonderful shelter for people who were homeless, and yet they weren't used.
There's never been any sincerity in helping the public with anything FEMA's done. Just because they state emergency in their title doesn't mean that it's an emergency in which people should be or could be helped by them. They let everyone down at FEMA. They let everyone down in the hurricane that hit New York. They've never done anything effective or effectual. So that's not their purpose. Their purpose is in running these detention centers that we call FEMA camps.
Well, who are they for?
You.
I don't have a reservation. I may after all these conversations. I mean, my husband Patrick Cook. Now him, I would believe. I mean, they would have come for him long ago, but he cut out of here and he died. So you know, I fully expected somebody to come for him at some point, but not me. I'm the sweet innocent one that's all spiritual and mushy, and I'm the one that's yelling conspiracy. Watch out! There's trouble. It's a smokescreen. And I have just some of the documentation that I found. But as someone who works with energy, I can tell you that energetically something is going on, and there is a disruption in the force, so to speak. Something's going on, and I really don't think President Obama has anything to do about it. I think he's a puppet. I don't think he has any power anymore. I think somebody's pulling his strings and has been all along.
Well, this is true of the executive office now. ever since Lyndon Baines Johnson was advised from his Lord and Masters what he would do on the plane ride back to Washington, D.C., after he had been sworn in as to succeed JFK. The reporter sitting next to him on the plane said he got a phone call and his face turned white.
Wow.
You have to understand that that act, that single act of assassinating the president right in front of all those witnesses, something that could have been, had there been any intention to avert, could have been averted very easily, but the way the Secret Service misused the bubble that wasn't placed on over the limousine, the fact that people in Dallas had expressed a desire that he be dead, and the advice that that the White House was given, and he may not have received. We have no really certainty that he did receive it, but he had made himself a marked man once he broke with the tradition of being led around by the nose by the State Department, the big oil companies that have more control over the State Department than anyone else, CIA that serves them like puppy dogs. All of this, and one man took them all on. One man blew the whistle on them and said, we were not going to operate under secrecy anymore. And since his death, it's grown worse and worse. So,
well, he didn't want the war. He wanted the war to end, and Johnson wanted it to continue, was my understanding, and I don't know if that's a, you know, if that's
Johnson once made a statement that he had one, he had to choose. He had either to accept being able to push forward civil rights, or he could end the war and do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, he could have the war and let McNamara run it, or he could turn his back on civil rights. He made the wrong choice, of course. I mean, that's what he said. I think that civil rights was an important issue, but I think the war in Vietnam gave so much power, extended the power in the reach of the military-industrial complex so far that it is that they have been out of control ever since, and that probably it would have been more important not to have had that war. But that's what LBJ mentioned, and to more than one person, and this is the way that that power is traded. And you see how when a president wants to advance an agenda, how he works Congress. This president has had the media on his side no matter what he does. Mm-hmm. The media has had more power in promoting the New World Order agenda than any estate. And if you bear in mind that how well he has been treated, and how that anyone that interviews him and that he doesn't like gets in trouble, like Charlie Sheen. Charlie Sheen interviewed him over 9-1-1. How did that end up? Charlie Sheen lost his the most successful series on television.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to throw in something about Charlie Sheen. I really like that guy. And that show, by the way, was really entertaining. 2 and a Half Men?
Yeah.
That was a funny show.
It was. It isn't now, but it was.
Well, it was by virtue of Charlie Sheen's charm and, I mean, charisma. This is a case where a producer who reputedly was Zionist was called upon to create such a disruption with him that he was dropped from the show, and Charlie Sheen placed the significance of that on the producer. But in truth, something was behind that. And I believe quite firmly that it was a White House using their influence to get even with him, because he made Obama look like an idiot. Any question that he asked, somebody had to come up and whisper in Obama's ear. And now, I don't know if you can still find that interview, but if you have any doubts about what I say, watch it yourself.
You've mentioned something else here that I have a personal feeling on, and it's not real popular, but I still have the personal feeling on it. And again, I'm not as politically gifted as all of you guys, but I have the advantage of having, I don't know, intuition. We'll call it intuition. I believe that this country has manipulated disasters in order to become mercenaries. And I believe you mentioned it just earlier, 9/11. I still believe that was something that was manipulated from this country in order to enable us to go attack and you know, shoot somebody, you know, take a
majority of the American people believe that too. American people know that the weapons of mass destruction that was reputed to Saddam Hussein was BS. They know that.
Yeah, but 9/11 itself, I believe that our government did that. I don't believe it was conspirators.
Well, that again, it was a false flag to get us into war with Iraq. Yeah. And that was just the beginning. Since then, two other nations have fallen. Any nation that will not abide by the OPEC rule of accepting only American dollars for their oil, it's going to be in trouble. That's the problem that they have with Syria. That's the problem that they're having with Iran. The threat to the petrodollar, and you have to understand that the petrodollar is the only reason we're not suffering hyperinflation right now, because the industry in America, it no longer exists. We have been deindustrialized the same way England has, and the jobs aren't there, the industry isn't there. I mean, we are the most warfaring nation on earth, yet we don't have a steel industry. And someone that we have as an antagonist more often than not, China, is producing our steel. Now, what sense does that make? We are a country sold out.
Well, yeah, and you know what really upsets me is we have enough oil in this country to supply this country, and yet all of the oil, it's my understanding that the majority, if not all of the oil that is pumped in this country is sent overseas.
Well, oil is another false flag in itself. We don't need oil. There is alternative energy resources that will not harm the environment. Everybody knows this. They're here now. And the extent, you just take one for instance, solar energy. Mm-hmm. The time has come. They have the photoelectronics now. That solar energy will pay for itself. Whatever you have to expend to install it, your recovery is 3 or 4 years at the most, and you're 100%. You're off the grid, and that includes using a wind turbine or batteries, a heavy bank of batteries for those days when there's no sun. Mm-hmm. So this is now. We had General Motors and Toyota both produced an exceptional electric car, and this little devil would run 9,500 miles an hour, no problem. It was the EV1, and it was so successful it scared the hell out of them, and they closed their factories down. They had sold all these cars, and a lot of them to celebrities that wanted to keep them, but they wouldn't sell them except on a lease. So under the terms of the lease, they could take them back anytime they wanted, and that's what they did, and they cubed them all except for one. So when we know this, and we know that there are batteries today that could have given that car more ability, if a car, an electric car, can go further on one charge, then it could go on a tank of fuel. It is feasible plus, plus, plus. And this one could. And they have, and this isn't even tapping into the batteries that they use in the probes and in the different rovers and so forth that they put in their space program that, I mean, these things have been running for years on batteries.
You know, James, you bring up an excellent point there. There is a Volkswagen now, and you can Google this and find it, that will get something like 260 miles on a single charge. We now have a completely practical, well, I don't know how much it costs. Maybe it's real expensive. I'm not sure, but there is a lot of stuff that's being hidden from us.
Yeah, we're no longer the land of the free and the home of the brave, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
Well, and you talk about the false flags. These things are so profitable because the people that cause them know exactly when they're going to happen, and they can leverage their money on the commodities market and on the stock market and make a pile of money with a disaster. Now, we have organizations, government agencies that are supposed to police that. But when a corporation like BP or AEG or any of these big boys do something like this, everyone looks the other way. Because why? Because they're too big to fail. What the hell does that mean? Right now, I'd say this country is failing.
Yeah, it's too big to fail.
And if it isn't bigger than these monster corporations, then I can't imagine what it is, what kind of stilts they're standing on.
Barbara, I wanted to ask you about these children that are getting survival packs. Are you able to elaborate on that at all?
I only to the extent that they have commissioned the stuff for the school children, and over 300 school systems will be issued a 3-day emergency kit for each student in September. Jeez. And I know that also is mentioned in the material I gave you on the Michigan, the state of Michigan, and that's where a lot of these disaster vehicles were set. And I know as I said before, I know the wife of the man that delivered them. So I'm pretty absolute on that one.
Barbara, do you think she'd be willing to speak on the radio? Would she be willing to talk?
I would probably think not, because her husband's job would be in jeofarty.
Yeah, of course.
Nice thought, but I don't think so. I think that she likes to eat a lot more than, you know.
Right.
But the stuff in Michigan that I sent you, I mean, they are saying that everybody should be prepared, that everybody, you know, for emergencies and disasters. And this is something new. This is something that has never been there as specifically as it is now, about keeping water, keeping food, keeping batteries, keeping for emergencies. I mean, they are so pushing this be prepared that I have water stored. Now I always have water stored, but you know, I'm glad I do now.
Sorry, Barbara, I didn't mean to interrupt you. James, you mentioned 3-man coffins being sent to these FEMA bases. Can you tell us more about that?
Oh, this was on a documentary that Jesse Ventura did, and they showed them. They showed them piles of them in one place. There must have been 250,000 of them stacked up. And Alex Jones was with Jesse Ventura when they were showing them. And, of course, it wasn't very far from a FEMA installation, but it was just out in the woods.
Yeah.
They'd plowed down the trees and made way so they could stack them out there. If you do any research online, you'll find the companies that make these things and the body bags. If you have any doubt that their plans for depopulation have been in the works and been treated seriously by think tanks and by pundits and people like Bill Gates and and Ted Turner, just read. Just research it. You know, put in a search engine. If you have a really good search engine, just type in Bill Gates' thoughts on depopulation, Ted Turner's thoughts on it, or something in that respect. If you just keep trying to change things around, you'll get it. You'll get the articles where they've talked about what a good thing this is and how necessary it is for the planet and all this crap. And, you know, Bill Gates became one of their tools back whenever he was in an antitrust suit over monopolistic practice in with his operating systems. And Department of Justice was threatening to break his huge corporation up. And so suddenly you have no problem at all. I mean, it's all gone away. And the next thing that happens is they've sold their Microsoft operating systems to Germany, to the government of Germany. Germany has them about 6 weeks and sends them all back with the comment, if we had wanted to network with Langley, we would have networked computers with them ourselves, because they found out they were all backdoored. Your operating system, if it came from Microsoft, has a backdoor file in it. You can turn it off. I have a friend that showed me how to do it, where you can turn that off. But a lot of people never thought of that, and today the NSA is involved. It doesn't make any difference whether you do that or not, because they're listening to our conversation right now and probably recording it. But what I'd like to say is that the October 1st deadline for so much of this stuff to be delivered to FEMA and other agencies of the government that are involved in some kind of anticipated emergency, and it created a vaccine for MERS and a vaccine for SARS and a vaccine for this and that. And they'll all say a candidate vaccine. You know what that means? That means it may work. But with it being a candidate vaccine, they're still going to try and force you to take these shots. And this is the same kind of thing. Remember the H1N1 antivirus or the vaccine that they were going to force people to take?
And I lost him.
Oh, yeah. I absolutely remember that.
Well, when that happened, there were some nurses in New York State refused to take it. And then there was a lady that was in the military that came forth, and she says, yeah, and they're going to chip you at the same time. They'll come to your door. If you haven't volunteered to take this, they'll come to the door. They will force you to take it, and they will chip you. So, there was public outroar to it, and it went away. It went away. Don't you remember?
So the chip is in the vaccine.
No. I think that was a separate deal. They were going to give you the vaccine and then chip you with. I think that it was supposed to be in the hand.
Yeah.
And what they have now is they have a nano chip that they can put in your arm, and it's not much bigger if it's as big as a grain of rice. And they tout that, but they have chips that'll do things they don't admit. They have chips that'll affect your behavior, like the one that they recently found in Napoleon's skull.
Aren't the military chipped?
Who knows? I've heard different things. I was out at the base one time, and this was back 9 years ago. I was out at the base one day, and they had some, I would say, probably Middle Eastern, I didn't recognize their patches, but they were trainees, pilot trainees, and they were up at the checkout, and when it came time to pay, they had this, the price reader, the barcode reader, just passed over their hand.
I got to jump in here, and it's going to take us off track a little bit, but I don't want us to go too far off track. You just dropped a bombshell, James. You said a chip was found in Napoleon's skull?
Yeah.
Now, that is a huge, huge statement. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, it's been in the news for a while now, but I commented on it. I was asked by a close friend about it.
Who had the technology back then to create a microchip and put it in Napoleon's head?
Aliens?
No, they had technology to go back now and put it in Napoleon's head to change history.
Oh, what? They're traveling in time.
Yeah. Well, remember, I've always said one thing, and I've said it over and over again, but so few people understand the ramifications of it, because it is hard to get your mind around. And I say, if time travel is possible, will ever be possible, has ever been possible, it is with us now.
Now, James, I want you to hold on to that thought, because I would like to pull my second-hour guest in now. And after the first hour is finished, you guys please hang on if you can. And I would like kind of Ole Domegaard to dominate the conversation a little more during the second hour, but I think it's going to be very interesting, Painter, if you could pull him in now.
Who?
Ole Domegaard.
Who?
I don't have him on my Skype.
Okay.
Leave.
Search for Ole Damegard. Now, Ole is very interesting. He has been, for the last 20 years, researching assassinations all over the world. And he has found that it's the same group that's assassinating these world leaders all over the world. And he has had to move to Spain to save his behind, so to speak. And I would like to pull him in. Something tells me if we can get this chemistry between all three of you guys, it'll be great.
Pull him into the Skype chat window right here. Drag him over, and I can click on him and call him right back.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to send him a message. Okay, he may be just temporarily away from his computer. Hang on, this is not working. Go ahead, guys. Continue to talk. I didn't mean to interrupt you. You were talking about time travel and the chip in Napoleon's head, which absolutely just blew me away, James. Continue, please.
Well, the Rothschilds were able to become equal with the crown by knowing ahead of time what the outcome at Waterloo would be and being able to hedge that in investments that they made, and that was the only time the Rothschilds ever risked any money. And they have been confronted about this, and they said, "Oh well, we had an observer near the battlefield to watch, and he sent a pigeon across the Atlantic." And no, they set this up before the battle, and This is how they did it. If you know the outcome of something like that before it occurs, you can take steps to benefit tremendously, especially when you already have the resources that they had. But that consolidated it for them and made it able for them to exercise virtually complete control over English finances. And from that point on, they became a power to reckon with.
Let me interrupt you just for a second, James. I wanted to welcome Ole Domegaard to the conversation. And he's going to kind of dominate the conversation during the second hour. But I just wanted to pull him in a little bit early. I think he's going to add an interesting bit of information, because this conversation is very interesting. Ole, his area of expertise is these assassinations that really go on all over the world, and they seem to be by the same people. Ole, we've got Barbara DeLong on, who is an intuitive, and James Horak, who defies description. The man seems to know a little bit about everything, or a lot about everything. he talks about these electromagnetic vehicles near our sun, and what he's discussing now, just to bring you up to speed, is the elite, allegedly, James, you're saying have time travel capability, and they are messing with our timeline, so to speak? Is that what you're saying?
Well, any time that you intrude on a continuum the way they did in doing this, you create an alternative timeline. And that's what we are in, an alternative timeline now. Now, they did this in the base timeline. In the base timeline, Napoleon wins at Waterloo. In this timeline, he doesn't. And that gave the Rothschilds a tremendous amount of wealth, and they have used it and orchestrated one event after another. They could now go to a level of being able see, before, they had for so long, for 200 years, they had a monopoly on lending. And they were financing war. But after Waterloo, they were able to promote war. And they have promoted war ever since.
So we are the singularity? We are the alternate reality? We aren't the base timeline?
Not the base timeline. And I point to something that people can do for themselves and see what I'm talking about. If you get a software that will show you a fix on the sky at any time, any place, go outside at night, get your fix, and look at it. You'll see that the sky isn't right. Constellations aren't where they should be. The moon's not tracking the way it should across the sky, even in migration. The sun may be setting too far to the south or too far to the north. All these things you see for yourself, and there'll be times when it's very, very obvious.
But if they go back and they correct that change, would not our reality cease to exist?
That's right. That's very sharp. That's exactly what would happen. It would terminate this timeline. It'd be as if it never existed.
Ole, this is probably very metaphysical for you. I know maybe your research hasn't got into this aspect of things, but you've probably stumbled across the Rothschilds in your research, correct?
Yeah, many, many times. They're big players in this whole game, for sure.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit, and what role are they playing from your perspective?
The Rothschild family is very central in the global elite, as far as I see it, and I mean major. Other families are the Rockefellers, DuPont, J.P. Morgans, and so on. But then it goes down in different groups, like the Bilderberg Group, the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, and so on. It's a big power pyramid, and where the Rothschilds are massively way, way, way up in the top, as far as I know.
And how are they involved in these assassinations, which you've been researching?
Well, they're very central. The power elite behind more or less all of these so-called terror acts, it's the same power elite behind them. It's just, and like you said before, what I've spent almost like 30 years is to track down how they do these, how they get away with these assassinations, how they use false flag operations to try and manipulate our minds and force us into their agenda without noticing what's going on. And no, the Rothschilds are very, very central in this.
And didn't you, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, I have to get my notes out here. Didn't you write a book on the assassination? Was it the Prime Minister of Sweden?
Yes, that's true. My book is called Coup d'etat in Slow Motion. And it's, like I say, it's almost 30 years of intense study on how that assassination was done, which is it's a very similar story to the JFK assassination. And it's much more than a Swedish assassination. It was done by the orders of the same elite, and it was carried out in a military fashion with a team of assassins in Stockholm with multiple getaway cars, and the Swedish police involved as well, with a with a fake investigation, which is working to this day, doing their utmost to cover everything up. And but what I've also been able to track down while I was going into very great detail and finding out what was had happened in Sweden, I found all these leads going to other assassinations, and I've even tracked down people who were in Stockholm in 1986 taking part of that assassination, who was actually also in Dealey Plaza 1963, the very same people. And this has pulled me back in my research back to the early 1960s, where one very central group when it comes to assassins is the so-called Operation 40, a group that was organized and created under the leadership of Dwight Eisenhower, President Dwight Eisenhower. But the man who was put to, who was given the task to put this group together was Richard Nixon. At that time, he wasn't a president candidate or anything. He was on a lower level, but he was the guy put in charge to create this group. And the to help finance the whole thing, who pulled in and all the funds to fund this group was George Bush Sr. The funds came from many different directions, oil companies in Texas, the military industrial complex, but also the financial interests that were being thrown out from Cuba at that time. This group was put together to take care of Fidel Castro, who was the big problem at that time. But then when Kennedy, after the Bay of Pigs disaster and the Cuban missile crisis, when he suddenly became unreliable for the elite, when he came to a point where he just felt, my God, I'm not going to be the one who starts this nuclear war and destroy the whole world. After that point, he suddenly became very unreliable to the elite. He wanted to crush the CIA. He wanted to get away from the Federal Reserve. He wanted to withdraw out of Vietnam, and so on and so on. There were many, many different steps that he just suddenly took a turn that was going very contrary to the elite's agenda, and that's why some of the reasons why they decided to take him out. And when you study the JFK assassination and you really start identifying what happened on a street level, who were the actual shooters, who were the spotters, where were they located, and so on, you will find many of the members of Operation 40 in those teams. If you want, later on I can identify all the people in Dealey Plaza, where they were and how they their tasks and so on. No, I just wanted to say that this group has been very active ever since the early 1960s, and they were part of the overthrow of Salvador Allende. They were part of murdering Che Guevara. They were one of them shot John Lennon. They were part in Stockholm as well, killing the Swedish Prime Minister. They were part of the Watergate break-in. They were very central in the Iran-Contras scandal, and so on. It just goes on and on and on. And one of them even got as far as to become the chief of the CIA, Porter Goss. This group is very, very central, and that's why I focused on trying to reveal as much as possible about them, to expose and to show what kind of tools and how they do these assassinations, because they use almost like a template. It's like a bullet point list of how to commit these crimes and how to get away with them, how to trick the public eye away from what actually happened, and how to also make the public think that it was the work of a lone crazy guy, which they always try to pin it on some crazy guy. The reason why they want him to be alone is that if there's more than one person involved, then it's by law has to be looked upon as a planned conspiracy. and the reason why they will always want him to be crazy or mentally weak or something like that is because then there don't have to be a reason for the assassination. He was crazy, he shot him, that's it, case closed. And lock him in or kill him or whatever, let him rot and just close down the case and move on.
And, Ole, I would like to hear again the name of the Prime Minister in Sweden who was assassinated, and I'd also be interested to learn why and how you left Sweden.
Okay, his name was Olof Palme. He was quite an interesting politician. Not that I'm interested in politics. I'm interested in finding truth and human rights. That's it. Not the political game. And Olof Palme was very interesting, I think, because he was a man of many faces. He was a man of the people officially, but behind the scenes he was working for the elite, for the banksters and so on. And he was also a member of the Bilderberg Group, quite a high level. He was also a member of the Committee of 300, very contrary to what the public in Sweden are aware of. They have absolutely no idea. And he was deeply involved in illegal arms deals on an international level, very close to the Iran-Contras as well.
So he was part of the elite, and the elite basically killed one of their own then, correct?
It's even more complex than that. I was on Red Eyes Creations, and we had like 8 hours about this conspiracy. It's a very, very complex, multi-layered conspiracy, so it's not easy to give a quick answer on that one.
So, and you mentioned that George Bush Sr. was involved in both the Kennedy assassination and in the assassination of the Prime Minister of Sweden. Is that true, or did I misunderstand that?
I didn't say that, but yes, that is true.
And Allende.
Sorry?
And Allende.
I tell you, George Bush Sr., he is one of the biggest criminals walking on this earth. When you really study what this man has been involved in, is absolutely incredible. I mean, it makes Hitler go for pale almost. It's like he's been involved, personally involved in so many of these horrific events and horrible things that has happened to the world the last 50, 60 years.
You know, I feel a sense of my emotion is a little bit stirred up by all of you here discussing this. It kind of gives me a sense of hope for the human race, because there are good people out there that are paying attention and that are studying this stuff. And Ole, you mentioned something that really perked my interest up when you talked about the assassination of John Lennon. Can you talk about that a little more?
Yes, of course. The thing with John Lennon is it's very important to see who this guy was, and he, as many other victims for these crimes, like Lady Diana, we have John Lennon, we have Bob Marley, we have Martin Luther King, Gandhi, and so on. The problem with these people and why they were taken out is because they stood up for peace. They stood up for love and brotherhood and stop going to war, stop taking part of all of these brutal mass killings and wars that the elites really try to push forward, because they thrive on death and destruction. That's the name of their game, death and destruction and rape and plunder. That's sort of what they're into. And when somebody stands up and people really listen to him, they become a problem for the elite. And that is why they are taken out one by one. And the reason also why they're taken out so violently, instead of, I mean, you could just slip a pill in a coffee or fake a heart attack or whatever. But one of the reasons why they take out people, both politicians and in this case, public figures, is to when they do it, for instance, when they took out Kennedy, what they did was to say to the rest of the power elite in the dark corridors of power that we can get anyone anywhere at any time, so you just back off and behave. dequiet. And this is why you, also why you, after when these assassinations happen or terror attacks or so on, they're always followed by almost like a conspiracy of silence from the official part. There's nothing said. And I don't know where it's, if it's inside my head, but I can hear somebody's calling.
Someone was trying to reach me on Skype. I'm sorry, guys.
No, don't worry about that.
But
if we go back to John Lennon,
yes,
he was just about to make his comeback album, and he had been away for quite a few years. And John Lennon was a guy that the rest of the world listened to, or at least millions of people were listening to him. And he stood up for peace and to stop war and all of these things, making it a major problem for this whole military-industrial complex. And people like J. Edgar Hoover and Lyndon Johnson, they hated him. They really, really hated him. And they tried to get rid of him in different ways before that, but he just wouldn't go away. So what they did was, on the evening he was killed, you have this this Mark Chapman guy, just like John Hinckley. Both of these patsies were officially friends of the Bush family, but both of these guys were also, I would dare to say, MK Ultra people. You know, I think you're aware of MK Ultra with Manchurian candidates. Yes.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
So. He had been there in the morning, and Mark Chapman was standing there waiting in the evening. He was standing to the right when the limo came to the Dakota building in New York. And when Yoko Ono left the car first and then followed by John Lennon, Yoko was like 5-6 meters ahead and got into the building. John passed Chapman, and then these shots that killed him was fired. But when you look at it, Chapman was standing to the right, and all the shots fired that hit John Lennon was fired from the left. So you don't have to be a very clever person to see that something strange is going on here. And the person standing to the left at that moment was a doorman that had jumped in that specific evening. A very nice looking gentleman in his, I think, early 70s, something like that. And his name was Jose Perdomo. He was mentioned in the very first articles published. And also you can hear there's a female witness on YouTube that is interviewed right after, just minutes after this shooting. And she said he was arguing with a doorman. He was arguing with a doorman. Anyway, so this doorman, his name was Jose Perdomo. And if you track this guy backwards in time...
There's the music. Oli, hold that thought. We'll be right back in 5 minutes, folks.
Okay.
You are listening to Revolution Radio, listener-supported radio, so please, folks, press that PayPal button and make a donation. You're not going to hear radio like this anywhere else. Tonight's show is absolutely astonishing, amazing, and fantastic. We've got our producer, Ahmad Painter. We've got James C. Horak. We've got Oli Domegard and Barbara DeLong here. You know, love is really what the elite oppose. They killed a musician. For heaven's sake, they killed John Lennon, a singer. And I love John's song, Imagine. And Barbara, I'm sure you remember the show we did together where you picked that song as the intro song. It amazes me, the overlap and the harmony that you get when you bring these different personalities together discussing some of these topics. Barbara, can you comment on that?
Well, yeah. You know, there is an underlying foundational commonality amongst everything, major religions, everything else, the message that is being given in a plethora of ways, on different wavelengths, to different channels, to different, is, you know, love is the answer. We have to come to a time when we take care of one another, recognize the fact that we are one family, and that all of the major religions, which we don't need if we could just remember the fact that the golden rule is what really is guiding us. Of course, then we wouldn't need governments either, so I imagine the big corporate structures all over the place would hate to have us all discover the simple truth that, you know, as one family, we are so powerful, it's unbelievable, and I do believe there is a cosmic brotherhood that's waiting for us to figure all this out if we don't destroy ourselves first. But the message is being given in so many different ways and so many different modalities, so subtly that people don't recognize it. I mean, the words to imagine are phenomenal. And I think that there are people out there that are sending that message out as best they can. And those that are doing a really good job are being killed.
You know, love is not model and sentimentality. And when I listen to Ole, what I'm really getting is the underlying message, even though he's elaborating on assassinations, I think the underlying message is love, and that's what I'm picking up on. James, can you comment on that at all?
On love?
On love and what we're talking about.
The value for life foremost. If you have become so hardened that you can watch a man shot down or a woman or a child killed in cold blood, and not be just outraged to the point of having to take action, then you are not human. You have lost, you sold your humanity out. We wouldn't have heard about My Lai, for instance, if a warrant officer, it was flying a gunship, hadn't seen what was going down below him and stopped him. Because at that time, there were teams that were formed and run by special forces. It would wipe out entire villages, every man, woman, and child, and it was standard operating procedure. So, but it wasn't for the men like this warrant officer who had honor and decency, and he had exactly what I'm talking about. He had love. Love is powerful. But when people talk about chiming or oming or whatever and raising to a higher vibration, that's a bunch of BS. Love is got strength, courage, and this movie 300, let me tell you something. There's no greater love than laying down your life with other men for a cause that you can't walk away from. And that is what is ahead of all of us.
Ole, I intuitively am getting that the reason you've dedicated yourself to the study of all these assassinations for all these years, these assassinations that are going on all over the world, is because of a very, very deep concern for the human race. Can you elaborate on that at all?
Do you know, I saw a quote from Bob Marley, who was also killed, even though people think he died from cancer, but I can go into that as well. He was a slow assassination. And he said, "I'm a very simple man with very simple wishes. I just want to unite mankind." And without being big-headed, I feel exactly the same. I have no idea how to do it, but I will do my utmost with that as my goal. And whatever I can do to help to accomplish that, that is why I'm here. And I feel almost like a cancer surgeon, you know, that there's this beautiful, beautiful Mother Earth and the whole civilization that is beautiful in itself. And then there's this cancer growth. It's not so big, but it's very, very malignant. And if we don't expose it, it will kill the body. It will kill us all. But what I feel super optimistic, even though these are very, very trying times, because the elite group that are holding us by the throat is such a small group of so-called powerful people. I mean, they're powerful due to that they have a lot of money in their pocket, or maybe they have beautiful suits and nice cars. But when you look at it, it's just like the Wizard of Oz. It's a big joke when you think of it. Maybe they're a couple of thousand. We're like 9 billion. So it's an absolute joke that we call them powerful, even though they are on TV and we are not. What does that has to do with anything? So it's just like the Wizard of Oz, where we come to this castle, and there's this massive voice saying, "Be fearful, be afraid, we control you," and like that. And then suddenly we discover that behind the curtain there's this little old man with a massive microphone and a big amplifier. And it's the same here. This is a bunch of old men that are just terrorizing the world, because they're behind so much of the so-called bad things that are going on in the world. This little tiny group is behind. I mean, what I've been looking into, so many so-called terror acts. I've looked into assassinations. I looked into civil wars. I looked into, you name it, I've been there. And big wars as well, like the world wars. And I've been to war zones. I tracked down agents. I've done a lot. And every single time, whatever case I've ever looked into, somehow or other, it's leading back to the same group here, which gives me a lot of hope, because it's just like in a schoolyard and you got one massive bully that is terrorizing the neighborhood, and we are so many and he's only one. And it's sort of like, in my opinion, I do not believe in revenge. I don't believe in hatred. I don't believe in anger if you can avoid it. But I totally believe in standing up, do not bend. It's the whole Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King approach to the whole thing, I believe in. Because when you look at so-called revolutions, I know that your radio station is called Revolution Radio, but revolutions is also, the word itself says, repeating itself. And when you look at revolutions in back in history, every single time, at least as far as I've been able to see, every single time the people that take over the power, within a few years they're sometimes worse than the people who were there before. So that's not the way to go either. I believe in what they did in South Africa with the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, where the main thing was to heal the past. There was so much bad things that had been going on, so much suffering and death and destruction, but there was only one way to move, and that was forward with compassion and forgiveness, and by exposure, by transparency, that by people coming forward, whistleblowers that changed sides and came forward telling the truth, exposing what they had been part of, that was part of the healing process. And now I've seen beautiful examples of former secret agents for the apartheid regime who are working side by side by people they used to torture. And now they, both of them, see that they were sort of victims in this game that was ruled by some people behind this curtain that they weren't even aware. Everybody was doing what they thought was the correct thing to do at that time. So,
but Mark, one thing that you know, I think has been sloughed by here that's really important. If indeed these powerful people are able to do what they've done, if indeed they can time travel, if indeed we are the alternate reality and not the baseline reality, isn't the fact that when humanity, at least our humanity, comes to the realization that, you know, that love is the answer and that love is the whole thing and that we fix what went wrong, isn't the ultimate act of love the fact that we will sacrifice our reality in order to make another reality more perfect?
Mm-hmm. That's a question for James. I'll give that to James. Can you answer that, James?
The lady is very erudite. I'm very impressed with you. we have to understand, and until you actually see it and experience it, when a gun is put in your face, you're a different person. Love becomes a matter of protecting those you love. And until you've had that experience, you don't understand. And, you know, one thing that Americans don't have is that we haven't been occupied by a foreign army in a very long time. Europeans have. Most Europeans have experienced what it is like to be bombed several times a week, like in London during World War II, or they have actually been occupied by a foreign army. And they remember that, and that's there are people in France today that prefer horse meat. And the reason is that during occupation, you will eat whatever you can. So they ate their horses. When you understand that exigency comes along and changes your view of what is this and what is that, you know, without knowledge, love has no meaning. Love has absolutely no meaning. And then, you know, you're so susceptible to hatred. You're so susceptible to pettiness and foible. But if you have knowledge and you are wise, like when we look at these assassinations that Oli is very adequate about the knowledge, well, you have to look at why they happen. Allende was assassinated because he was fixing to nationalize Anaconda Copper for the benefit of his people. This is a big step against the power brokers in the world. And we don't realize the truth because our media lies to us. Our public schools betray their mission. Journalists are cowardly, and the few that are not are out of work very quickly. We have had a number of people with the truth and with knowledge so that we could operate wisely, that we could express our love for our fellow man productively. Because you can't do that. You can't. Love has no meaning without knowledge, without the knowledge that you need to be wise. We don't, the Americans today don't know what that military expedition down in Panama, what a bloodbath it was. They think that it was a relief effort to help the Panamanians get rid of a dictator, and nothing could be further from the truth. Noriega was at one time one of the right-hand boys of Bush Sr. He went through the School of the Americas in Washington, D.C. He was given all the torture devices that are made expressly for going down, setting your military dictatorship up, and terrorizing all your enemies for the State Department. So Noriega made one decent decision, and that was that he wouldn't let Panama get into a war with another nation by planting phony Kachi of arms that would be reputed to the Sandinistas, and then get into a war with Nicaragua over trying to frame the Sandinistas for something they had nothing to do with. So, this infuriated his once Lord and Master, George Bush Sr., so much that it became personal. And so they went down there and they massacred a number of civilians, massacred them. Burned down a good portion of the city, and instituted martial law on those people like they were criminals. And there you can see this as a documentary that is a full-blown movie. You can see it for yourself. You can see what happened. And, of course, no American up here got any of this through the mass media. And When Allende was executed, what led to his execution was that truckers in Panama were paid by the CIA not to deliver anything to the cities. So after about 4 or 5 days, things became unstable because these people weren't getting food, they weren't getting the necessary social services they expected, and who are they going to blame? Well, Allende was very popular, he was democratic, but he's also a nationalist, and that's why he wanted to nationalize Anaconda Copper, because this was a national resource that had been exploited under colonialism, and it continued to that day.
Ole, I would like for you to talk again about this slow assassination. Can you elaborate on the on this technique that was used against Bob Marley, and if you can also respond at all to what James was saying about George Bush Sr. in Panama?
Panama is just one in a long, long, long row of the same type of thing that has been done by this power elite, where George Bush is very central as well, where they create a dictator. They fund him, they arm him, they do whatever. And if there's a real leader elected by the people who stands for what is true and right for his country, they will just take him out and replace him with the dictator of their own choice. But then sometimes they, just with Noriega, they, after a while, they get pissed off with him, or they get tired, or they need a patsy, and then they will just use him for their own means, just like they did with Saddam Hussein and so on, and then use him to as an excuse to push their own agenda forward. So they turn him from one of their own into a devil. They paint him out as a devil so that they can have a reason to attack whatever that country is and invade it. They take one country after the other. They have like four or five different ways of approach it, how to take over different countries. But let me get back to, first I just wanted to tell you about John Lennon. This José Perdomo, he was actually, for 10 years, he was the highest commanding officer of Operation 40. And so, I mean, how big are the chances that you got one of the best assassins ever? And he was the doorman that specific day, just outside the Dakota building. I think the chances are not that very big that it's just a coincidence.
Don't you find that reminiscent of how Robert Kennedy was killed?
Robert Kennedy was also, all of these assassinations go very much hand in hand, and the same people appear. Like when it comes to Robert Kennedy, in the Ambassador Hotel that evening was one of the guys, a very, very high-ranking CIA officer, was David Morales, also called the Indio. David Morales was also present in Dealey Plaza, and he was also the guy who, under the command of Felix Rodriguez, George Bush right-hand type of butcher, Felix Rodriguez was the guy who was given the task to track down Che Guevara in Bolivia, and they found him, and the one who actually shot him or killed him was this David Morales, the Indio. And to this day, Felix Rodriguez is said to carry around Che Guevara's rich rods. Watch. So these people are still very active, even though they're up in their, most of them are up in their 80s.
Isn't it interesting that these people kill musicians, for heaven's sakes, Bob Marley and John Lennon?
No, not at all, because if you see when the military junta takes over in a country like Argentina or Chile or whatever, some of the first people they aim at are the people who can create an opinion among people, who can emotionally get people going, you know. So
the poets,
the artists, the singers, all of these, the actors, these are the people that are taken out very early, you know.
The finest poet that Spain ever had. Remember what the Franco regime did to him?
Yeah, they chopped him up right away. And you got Victor Jara in Chile. You got also part of Operation 40 and links to Operation 40, the Pablo Neruda, which was he was given the Nobel Prize in literature. He was killed just a week or so after that they took out Allende. And the guy who killed him, he was taken to hospital for an operation. And then there was this, he was called Mr. Smith. It was an American doctor that nobody had seen before. He came in and gave him an injection in his stomach while he was asleep. Oh, and this guy... This guy has been identified as Michael Vernon Townley, who is very high up, very skilled assassin, also more or less directly connected to Operation 40. His handler or controller was David Attlee Phillips, who was also the CIA handler of Lee Harvey Oswald. He was also the handler of one of the shooters, the guy behind the picket fence, James Files. And he was also the one who gave Michael Vernon Townley the order to kill Orlando Letier in Washington, D.C., in Embassy Row, where other people from Operation 40 as well were part of that. You had Virgilio Paz and you had Orlando Bosch. Orlando Bosch was a central figure with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of terror acts. They blew up airliners, they blew up all kinds of ships and shops and whatever during quite a few years. And on the order of George Bush Sr. As one of them. And then after he was finally caught and put to prison, he was pardoned by George Bush Sr. Go figure. It's the same story again and again. And can I just say, when it comes to George Bush Sr., it's almost proven now, 100%, that George Bush Sr. was actually in Dealey Plaza. He was in the Daltex building, together where there were the shooter in that building was Chucky Nicoletti from the Chicago mob. The spotter was Nestor Izquierdo, a black elite soldier who was also part of Operation 40. Then Johnny Rosselli, the contact for the Chicago mob, was in that building, and George Bush Sr. These four people were there in that building. I can go through all the other shooters as well.
I've heard that George Bush Sr. is a pedophile. Is there any truth to that?
I tell you, when it comes to this elite, there's a very, very sick, when it comes to sex, a very, very sick approach that I am, they're really into so much weird stuff. It's very, it's very infected and involved in Freemasonry networks and rituals and very, very odd things. And yes, as far as I know, there's a lot of children involved as well. Children, and also when you see the assassins themselves, very strangely, they're mostly right-wing extremists, like more or less Nazis, but very many of them are gay as well. I don't know how these two goes together, but it's almost like they are so opposed to female energy. It's just weapon, death, and gay sex, or with kids. I don't understand it.
They are opposed to female energy. That's quite interesting.
I think so. I don't know these things, but I can just see that it's a pattern that repeats itself. You have these very violent men, and do you know, like, muscles, weapons, death, and gay sex?
James, what could be better than female energy?
Well, from my point of view, I can't think of anything that would be better than female energy. Of course, I'm pretty straight. But one of the individuals that was involved in the JFK assassination was David Ferry, and he was gay.
Yeah, but you have David Ferry, you got Clay Shaw, you had Lee Harvey Oswald was also, and there's quite a lot showing that Jack Ruby was also gay. And then around the Olof Palme assassination, once again, you got these violent people and gay again and again and again. I'm saying absolutely nothing against gay people, bless them all, but it's a pattern that repeats And I don't know. It's just my own theory is this thing with a female energy. There's so also after. I'm sorry if I keep, if I'm just like a steamship here, but
there's
let a female jump in here.
Thank you, please do.
Absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yeah.
And with absolute power, you do find people seeing just how bizarre and weird they can get, and certainly with Caligula, with oh, let's look at King James. I mean, you know, it's something that is very, very common. This harmful sexuality that no longer is an expression of love, but it's an expression of dominance and power. And I think when you look at women, for the most part, that's a nurturing energy. And these people don't want to be nurturing at all. They want to control and dominate. So that you know, I can see why they would be homosexual. I can see why they would be. And again, there are some very wonderful, balanced homosexual people out there. But look at Hitler. He was just a teeny bit strange too. So teeny bit. So you know, you have this thing of needing to dominate and control, and that's not a loving energy. And so I don't think the element of love has any place within their realities. I think that it's control and dominance. And what better way to show that than to be abusive?
A lot of this has to do with how these people are raised as children.
Mm.
The elite intentionally brutalize their children. They should be nurtured. Well, where are they sending them? They're sending them to these military academies, or they're sending them here, they're sending them there. They miss so much of the closeness of a natural home, and of course they're touted as better than everyone else, and that take the Zionist attitude towards guys. Well, the rich and powerful have adopted something very similar towards the working class, and they have their favorite expression that they use with regards to the 95% of us they want to depopulate is that we're useless eaters. Mm. Now, all of these monsters have they made their money from us useless eaters in the way of consuming, haven't they? And now, all of a sudden, we're useless eaters. You know, they're parasites. They're parasites, and they dehumanize their children. And if they can't dehumanize them, they either put them in a convent, they put them away in an asylum somewhere, or they kill them. And this is what happened to the Kennedys. The Kennedys produced two human beings, and that wasn't the one that was being tailored for the presidency. The senior brother was the one, and he dies in a war. So it falls to JFK, and JFK seemed, you know, he's a human being first. And the issue evolves around whether or not when these people are given power, they're going to operate like the monsters that they are tailored to be. They take somebody with a character flaw, like Bill Clinton. At 12 years old, he was sort of adopted by the Council of Governors because they could see how useful he could become. He could be controlled towards certain inclinations they could see at that age. And they developed him, and they tailored him. They managed him into a Rhodes Scholarship, which he really never took, but that's not, if you go anywhere and you read about him, they'll suggest by omission that he did. But the fact of the matter is, he's lazy, he is prurient, and ill-disciplined. But he's exactly what they want as far as character goes. So he's tailored. If you want a moral imbecile, you know, the elite will raise you one.
James, that's so interesting. You were coming in kind of quiet there when you were talking just in the very beginning, so make sure you stay close to your mic there. Barbara, you brought up something interesting I just have to bring up. You said the King James, you talked about King James. Didn't King James like dead animals?
Oh, if it was sick and just, yes, he liked all sorts of weird stuff. And, you know, it's really funny because, you know, he sort of commissioned the King James version of the Bible that is in every motel hotel on the earth just about. And they think he must have been a holy man. And I mean, that is so far from the truth. And it was his whatever when it was translated that it be translated into the court English and not common English so that only those in the court could read it, that the common man could not. That's why it's so damn hard to really understand what the heck they're saying half the time. The these, the thous, and the those. So no, he was a sick bastard.
Well, I just had to bring that out. Go ahead.
Now, Wycliffe was a scholar, and the Wycliffe Bible is the most scholarly Bible that has ever been published, but it has problems. Wycliffe was persecuted for that. But just remember that before Gutenberg, the Catholic Church did not allow the Bible in any other language than Latin. And, you know, it wasn't available to anybody that wasn't one of the very few scholars that could read Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And this changed overnight, and there's a series on one of the channels, History Channel or Discovery One, that goes into detail about the four Inquisitions that we had. And if you want to see, there was one of the Florentine cities that specialized in books, in printing books and so forth. And in the Fourth Inquisition, they expressly went after the book dealers in that city. And they were getting rid of books that have been lost today. And it breaks my heart because I've always been a bibliophile. I've always hunted books, and it's to my detriment, actually. and to see something that I would give my eye teeth to just hold and read. Mm. But one of the things that has happened in this country in recent years is that things like interlibrary loans, keeping the libraries open on the weekends so working class men that have jobs and work during the week can have access to them. And I have known people in the working class who were itinerant but very well read, that knew more about Egyptology than people that profess to be experts today. That had knowledge, and you know, because they might pronounce things with a southern twang, or because they might, not know exactly what a hieroglyph was, that they were looked down on, and yet they had fantastic knowledge. And I think quite often of the best novel that was written during the Victorian era was written by a guy that nobody actually paid much attention to as a literature giant, and that was Thomas Hardy. He wrote Jude the Obscure. Mm-hmm. And that book is so realistic and so powerful to come to terms with that it puts Emile Zola down. But, I mean, if you will read that book and get an idea about the pomp and circumstance around institutions like Oxford and Cambridge, and how someone like Jude in this book, who masters Greek and Latin eloquently and still is looked down upon by these people that have all the pomp and circumstance of being able to parade a particular day and show all their robes and everything, and yet do not have near the acumen Jude the Obscure had. So,
don't you feel that there is a subtle difference between knowledge and wisdom?
Hmm.
Well, you can't have one without the other. I mean, as far as you being useful, functional, or whatever, I like what the... I was very much a student of anthropology, and I audited a lot of graduate courses in anthropology. And linguists and anthropologists, there's a combination at a certain level of graduate work, there's a combination of disciplines. And linguists and anthropologists get together and they try to decide cultural characteristics by language or cultural characteristics by other things other than just what they find in the ground and what they find by going over old records, codexes, and so forth. But one of the things that I've always appreciated is how people correct their children. The French, the Germans will say, get in line. The French will tell their children, be wise. And Navajos will tell their children, that's not the Navajo way. And I love that about cultures. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I know people that can, for instance, quote chapter and verse of the Bible, yet can't explain what it means.
Right.
Or have no concept. One of the things that I issue with is the fundamentalists who want to take everything literally and are so absurd. To me, a sailor or someone who is a good man, who takes care of his friends, takes care of his job, and it's very important at sea, who says an expletive, has not committed a mortal sin. He's not doomed his soul to hell. But a preacher, or an evangelist, especially these days, a tele-evangelist, that speaks for God has. In my opinion, that's blasphemy and not the pejorative.
You know, I wanted to interject here. I want to pull Ollie back into this conversation. Ollie, isn't it interesting that the elite are killing musicians? These artists are the people that are dedicated to beauty and love and self-expression. Can you explain that to us?
But I think it's what's been said all the time. They stand for love and affection and all these beautiful nurturing things, and the elite stand for death and destruction. They don't go together. And I would say that they actually fear love. Love is it's an incredible force when it's used in the correct way. I don't know if you can misuse love, real love, but I think that is an enormous power. And so I think it's very clear that these are the people they will take out first of all.
Have you ever read Bertolt Brecht?
No, I have not. I know him very well, but I haven't read a lot.
Read a poem that he wrote, The Infanticide of Marie Farrar. It has a refrain in it. But gentlemen, do not give way to indignation, for everyone needs the help of all creation.
Wow. That's profound.
It's about a woman that goes into a restroom and aborts herself.
Oh.
Because she is on the street, she's poor, she knows that her child doesn't have a chance, and that's what the poem is about. It is one of the most gripping poems I've ever read. And of course, Brecht was very famous for the three-penny opera, which is derived from the three-penny novel. And I got into it one time with a professor who had taught a course in Dryden, and he brought up John Gay's novel, the three-penny novel, and was comparing it to Brecht's three-penny opera. And I said, well, why don't you compare oranges and oranges instead of oranges and apples? He said, what do you mean? I said, compare it with Brecht's three-penny novel. And he said, Brecht never wrote a three-penny novel. And I said, okay, I'll bring it up next class. And I brought it up. And he said, may I borrow it? He took it home and read it. He came back and in front of the class brought the book back to me and said, you were right and I was wrong. Now, I didn't get good grades from him. That's true. But I swear that impressed me more about him than the fact that he was an insufferable critter. I think that he was the kind of person that give a graduate student an F.
Oh, my.
You just don't do that. You just don't give graduate student, because they fail with a C. Graduate student with a graduate student, a C is a failing grade.
Wow. Wow. Ole, can you tell us more about Lee Harvey Oswald? You mentioned that he was gay.
There's quite a lot of evidence showing that he, I wouldn't say he was gay, but he was maybe bisexual, that he was, this is thin ice I'm getting out on now, so I don't want to go deeply into it, but there's quite a lot pointing that he and Clay Shaw and David Ferry, and that he was at some of these parties. So, but at the same time, I mean, this was a man, he was married, but also had a love affair with Judy, what's her name, Baker. Where they were deeply in love, these two people. And so I think there's a lot more interesting aspects of Lee Harvey Oswald than his sexuality.
You mentioned that the techniques involved in some of our assassinations, I've heard this on another radio show, you mentioned that these techniques in these assassinations were actually developed by a Roman colonel. Is that true?
No. What I mentioned is that one of the methods they use is, they call it problem-reaction-solution. And that is an old Roman thing. It was an old Roman emperor colonel who came up with that one. It's like, if you would like me to give an example, it's because this is being used on almost a daily basis.
Sure.
It's, for instance, if, let me say, I'm here in Spain and I want the police to have a lot more power, military power almost. I want tanks in the streets. I'm the president of Spain doing this, okay? I want the police to be able to kick in doors, to have total surveillance everywhere and so on. If I would just do it, I would have a lot of problem with the population here. There would be lots of demonstrations. There would be a lot of underground movements. The more forceful I did it, I would have problems with mass arrest. I had to arrest a lot of people. I would fill the jails. I would. It would just go on and be a big problem. I mean, when you look history-wise, I would have to kill a lot of people, and then when I killed the people, their families would become the next enemies, and so on. It would just go on and get very messy. You can see that in Chile, Argentina, and so on, when they've done military coups. So instead, what I do is that I secretly create a problem. I, the one who has the agenda, I secretly create a problem. And this is nowadays, this is mostly done with a bomb. And this bomb, I place it, it's very important where I place it, because what I want to is get a reaction from the public so that I can come with a solution. So I place this bomb not in an old people's home, or a veteran, old soldiers, or anything like that. No. I place it to get the maximum emotional effect response from the public. So I need to have, I need the bomb to kill children, women, nuns, nurses, these type of things. That's the one that makes the impact. And so I secretly create this problem, and then at the same time, very often I create a patsy. I point out someone I'm angry with anyway, or have a problem with, or somebody totally innocent, but that it's easy to make suspicious. For instance, let's say green parrot, bird lover, something like that. Then in media, I leak out strange information about these green parrot trainers, that they have secret meetings on Wednesday where they teach the parrots to speak. Or something is stupid, you know, maybe like they make them say, quotes from the Quran or something like that. Super good. And that indirectly, I also happen to mention that they might have guns underneath the Green Parrot Center and secret tunnels or something like that. I leak that out in media. So I've created this problem with a bomb. And then it's very important that this bomb is blown up on prime time TV. So very often, to get the maximum emotional impact, I will make these bombs explode early morning when people have just, they're sitting having their breakfast, or they're still in awakening state. So you will very often see that these mass shootings or 9/11 or bombs or whatever it is that they do will be in the morning, very early in the morning.
And or then, at the finish line of the Boston Marathon.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That one is a massive false flag operation. And so when all of that is set up, then I alert media, so they're on standby, and then boom, when there's lots of kids and women are there, boom, I make the bomb explode. I get all of these awful, horrific images going out in media to create the reaction from the public saying, oh my God, something needs to be done. And then I, who secretly created the problem, say, well, I can solve it, you know, because this green parrot bird lover group, they're very, very violent. So the only way I can deal with this is by having tanks in the streets, the police being able to kick in doors everywhere, total surveillance everywhere, and that I can arrest anyone at any time and so on. And then the public would say, anything, just do it, you know, save us, because this has to stop. And so I would say, no problem. And in comes the tanks, in comes the... And instead of being the crook, I'm a hero. I knock out this bird-loving group, whatever. I put them away, boof. So that problem is solved. And then after a little while, I have martial law as well. Not that it's needed in any kind of way, but I have that to make people get more and more used to this situation. And then... after a week or so, I slowly withdraw, but I don't withdraw all of it. I will leave some surveillance cameras. I will leave some officers around because of for the people's security. It's always for the security of the people, not that I want total control. So it's this is how it's done: problem, reaction, solution. And you can see that again and again and again.
Ole, can you tell us a little bit about your website and your books and things like that?
Yeah, I would love to. My website is lightonconspiracies.com. Light on conspiracy, that means light as from a light bulb, not that it's not heavy. Lightonconspiracies.com. And one of my books is Coup d'etat in slow motion. Coup d'etat in slow motion. Because that is what happened in Sweden. It was a coup d'etat, but it was done in slow motion so that people did not understand what actually happened. Just like with JFK, I would say that the assassination of JFK was also a coup d'etat, but it was done in slow motion so that the people who killed Kennedy took over without the rest of the world understanding that the people in power afterwards were actually the ones that killed him. So if you look at the whole long row of presidents that have been there since Kennedy was assassinated, they're all part of the power group that took him out.
And yes.
And this is also the power group that to this day is behind so much of these horrific things that are happening on an international scale. I think it's very important also to see that this power elite, if you look at it as different countries, you make a mistake, because these people are from many different countries. It's key people handpicked from different countries put together in this elite group. So it's not by coincidence that suddenly George Bush say, for instance, like, let's start the war on terror. And then within 2 minutes, Tony Blair stands up and say, yeah, let's go start the war on terror. And then the Swedish Prime Minister stands up before anyone even knows what happened, really. And everybody supports this war on terror. This is just one example, but that these people from the outside, it doesn't look like they have any connections. But then when you see these secret brotherhoods and creations like the Bilderberg Group.
I hate to cut you off, but I got to shut down the server.
We are, thanks all of you. I'd like to thank all of you. I'm honored to know all of you, James Horak, Barbara DeLong, Ole Damgaard. Thanks, folks.